watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In their groundbreaking 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent, professors Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky not only explained but documented with extensive case studies how mass media and public opinion are shaped in a democracy. 20 years later, can their propaganda model still be used to explain modern media distortions? That was one of the main questions discussed last month at a conference at the University of Windsor in Ontario, titled 20 Years of Propaganda. We'll begin the program with a presentation from that conference by Sut Jolly, who teaches analysis and recognition of propaganda in the media at UMass Amherst, where he heads the Media Education Project. We'll follow that with the next installment of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, his work on the development of compulsory schooling in America and its social engineering goals, which were not to enlighten, but to mold the children of diverse cultures into a population useful to the agenda of corporate-controlled mass production and consumption. Here's Professor Sut Jolly.
As the title of my talk indicates, I want to talk about teaching and the propaganda model, or the usefulness of the propaganda model in the classroom. Now, certainly, the field of critical news analysis was not invented in 1987 by Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky. Many people were already dealing with the issue of corporate control of news and media. The work of Herb Schiller was already a tradition. In Canada, Dallas Smythe had reinvigorated debate about political economy in the Marxist discussion of communication. Ben Bagdikian had published the first edition of The Media Monopoly in 1983. In England, Nicholas Garnham had done major work in the political economy of communication. And, of course, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting had just been founded by Jeff Cohen in 1986. So there was already a great deal of work and a great deal of concern around media issues, even before Herman and Chomsky published their work. In fact, media issues, they've had some purchase on the left for quite a while. Gore Vidal actually reminds us that when Confucius was asked once, the ancient Chinese philosopher was asked once, what he would do if he were ever to rule the state. Like someone said, if you were in charge, how would you stay in charge? How would you remain in charge? He replied by saying he would, quote, rectify the language. Rectify the language. If he was asked today, he would say, control the media. If you control the stories that are told, then you don't need police and army on street corners. You control people in their own imaginations. You control people in their own heads. If you can control the categories of thinking, you can control the categories of thought. I think that there's been a great deal of awareness of that for a long time. And there, as I said, has been a great deal of work already by the time Herman and Chomsky published the work, already a great deal of work in that area. But what Manufacturing Consent gave me, and I'll speak to myself here as a teacher, was a systematic framework to put all these concerns in. That is, we knew about all these things, but it hadn't been brought together in the kind of systematic way the propaganda model puts it forward. And in fact, when I teach it essentially as a scientific model. That is, there is a theory that they develop on how on on why media content looks like it does. These can then be translated into a series of hypotheses about what media content would look like around certain issues, and then those hypotheses can be empirically tested. And that, I think, actually, that, and that's the way I used it in my classes, actually, was in that kind of scientific model. So you can plug, in fact, a lot of things into it. The propaganda model also allowed me to speak about something that is otherwise difficult to kind of theorize. It allowed me to speak about absences in a structured way. That is, what doesn't make its way into the discourse. Actually, I would argue what doesn't make its way in is actually much more important than what makes its way in. We have to have a way of talking about absences. And if you start with content, that can't get to the absences. The only way you can get to the absences is through a systematic structural analysis of why we see what we see. So absences, in fact, are very, very important, and the propaganda model gave me a way to look at that. And I said I'm going to talk a little bit about my own, the film work that I've done, but also what I've done in class as well. And that's the way I used the propaganda model in my classes. I looked at a number of domestic and international issues and tested a series of hypotheses about the institutional relationships of news gathering and reporting. And I think that is the great strength of the model, is that it can be easily tested. It can be easily tested. Like someone actually in the midday event today said, you know, when they talk to people, they say, prove it. You know, this is about proving that racism exists or sexism exists. Well, I actually think it's a good question. And we should be able to answer these, and we should be able to frame our discussions empirically. We should be able to frame our discussions in terms of evidence. That is a good terrain for us to be on. And when I say us, I mean progressives on the left. Because we have the virtue of having history on our side. We have the virtue of having, in fact, the facts on our side. It allowed me to bring in the news coverage from, again, as a model, it allowed me to bring in news coverage from the front pages or from the network evening news and deconstruct it from this institutional perspective. Or talk about what was not there and why not. And that is what the model is. The model is precisely a model into which many things can be plugged. And partly, it is its flexibility, I think, that is the most useful aspect of its pedagogical use. Now, clearly, the model needs to be adapted to changing technologies and shifting political times. But because the propaganda model is an institutional approach, it can be easily, I think, adapted. For example, and I'm sure there's, I know there have been other papers written around these issues at this conference, the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, has meant that the predominant ideological filter, anti-communism, virtually disappeared overnight. Actually, if you want to, if you're teaching undergraduates, ask them about communism. They don't even know what communism is anymore. And why should they? Because, in fact, it's no longer a part of their world. Of course, a new ideological filter has been put in its place, the war on terror, that fulfills essentially the same filtering function. In addition, new technologies such as the internet, I think, can be plugged into the model. The model is not driven by technology. It's an institutional approach. And therefore, you can actually plug different media technologies into that. Now, partly as a result of... for me, the propaganda model, as I said, I'm going to speak from my teaching perspective. The propaganda model for me was actually very useful pragmatically in terms of dealing with, and I'm talking about teaching not even upper level classes, I'm talking about teaching introductory level classes at the freshman level and trying to get students to think in critical ways or in analytical ways about the world that surrounds them. And so the model was especially useful for me. But I also realized, as I was doing it, and I think most people who are teachers will perhaps identify with this, I also realized the difficulty of teaching these issues in a college classroom, in colleges and universities. And as I thought about that, this was at the same time that I was working with the Media Education Foundation. I founded the Media Education Foundation to make films to be used in classes, particularly around these issues. And so I actually started to think about doing a film around the propaganda model that could be used in college classrooms. And I started, worked with Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky, and we supplemented it with with some work by my colleague at that time at the University of Massachusetts, Justin Lewis. And we produced the film, actually I don't even have a date, but I think it was 1998, which we call The Myth of the Liberal Media. And that film was based, and the subtitle actually is The Propaganda Model of News. Now when we teach, and I actually wish more people would take teaching seriously, I wish more people would actually think about teaching. Because in fact, it is a very, very difficult context in which to operate. Because you've got to think about where your students are. You've got to think about where your audience is. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be very good teachers. Because we may think ourselves, we're communicating content, but unless we are actually communicating something that is engaging people, we are not engaged in pedagogy. So when I started to think about this, and from my own experience, the starting point of the film became where students were with their own understanding of politics and media. Where they were in terms of their own understanding of how the media function. And at the time we did this, I don't think it's changed very much. The major way in which people thought about the media, the major way, was that it had somehow a kind of liberal tint, a liberal bias, and hence the notion of the liberal media. So we had to start the film there. I mean, just as an aside, it's really, I actually get annoyed every time I have to talk about the liberal media. Because it's such a ludicrous thing to talk. It's such a ludicrous thing. If the media were liberal, they would be a unique institution in the history of humanity. In that they would be working opposite to the very people that control it and fund it. Right? It is one of the stupidest ideas you can ever hope to think about. And yet, that is the only question. The media, that is the only question that culture will allow us to ask. They learned well from the Nazis. Right? You're gonna lie, lie big. You're gonna lie, lie big. The sky is green with pink dots. No, it's not, it's blue. The sky is green with pink dots. The sky is green with pink dots. The sky is green with pink dots. Actually, no, that's not a dot really. That's like a cloud. And as soon as you're on that terrain, you're lost. That is the power of the media, is to be able to frame a question. And that is what the notion of the liberal media does. It is meant to, in fact, deflect us away. That is, when the media is controlled in the most narrow way by corporations, by advertisers, as Herman and Chomsky have demonstrated, then you can't ask that question. You have to deflect attention away and ask about... The only question we're allowed to ask is this notion of the liberal media. So we started off the film on that basis. So what I'm going to do is, I said I was going to be not serious by theorizing. I'm going to show you a series of video clips to keep you entertained, especially as you get to the dessert part of your meal. And so the first clip I want to show is from the film that we did, The Myth of the Liberal Media, because we're also faced at the same time. One of the questions that I've actually found myself coming back over and over again pedagogically, and as a filmmaker, when we make these kind of films, is how do you take an abstract idea like the filters? That is an abstract idea. And how do you make it concrete? How do you make it visual? How do you figure out a way to be able to speak to students who are thinking about these things for the first time? I think that is the great pedagogical challenge. That I wish, as I said, I wish more people would keep in the front of their mind rather than in the back of their mind. So this is the first clip from, it's the opening of The Myth of the Liberal Media.
Liberal Media is not a liberal media. It's the role of the news media is central to the modern democratic process. For most people, the news media is the dominant source of information about the world. They tell us what matters, they tell us who matters. The way we vote or the way we respond to opinion pollsters is based largely on media information. So the quality of a democracy now depends upon the information they provide.
The mainstream media really represent elite interests, and they serve those elite interests in a way that can be described as carrying out a propaganda function.
If you want to understand the way some system works, you look at its institutional structure. How is it controlled? How is it funded? And so on.
Big question, of course, is what kind of information do we get? Does it come from a diverse range of perspectives, or are some views dominant and others excluded? The most commonly repeated theory is that the media tilt towards the left or to the liberal end of the political spectrum. What's curious about this view is that there's almost no evidence to support it. In fact, the bulk of evidence suggests that the media typically biases the other way. The spectrum of opinion most often represented goes from centre to right, while voices on the left are generally absent. This is the essence of Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's thesis.
In the last 10 or 20 years, there's been massive research documenting the fact that the media are extraordinarily subordinated to external power. Now, when you have that power, the best technique is to ignore all of that discussion, ignore it totally, and to eliminate it by the simple device of asserting the opposite. If you assert the opposite, that eliminates mountains of evidence demonstrating that what you're saying is false. That's what power means. And the way you assert the opposite is by just saying, the media are liberal. Okay, now the question that we discuss is, are the media too liberal or are they not too liberal?
We're talking about your letter saying that the media were biased in the last election.
The bulk of our mail supports the notion that there's a definite liberal tilt to the news media.
All right, now that we've narrowed the agenda to the one acceptable question, are the media too liberal, let's have a look at the way it's argued. If you want to show that, you would look at the media product and you would try to demonstrate that it reflects a slant or a distortion supporting a liberal agenda. Nobody does this. That would take a little work. Because if you did it, you'd immediately fall on your face because it works the other way. So what's done is to produce a proposal which is so idiotic that you have to wonder at the cynicism of the people who are putting it forth and their contempt for the population. The proposal is the following. Let's ask how journalists vote. Okay, so we find, let's say, 80% of them vote Democratic. Okay, we've now proven the media are too liberal. It proves nothing. First of all, no matter what, even the facts are right, it proves zero. You could find that 99% of the journalists are members of the Socialist Workers' Party, or some Maoist group, and that in itself would prove nothing about the media output. The issue is whether the media are free. Are the media, by their institutional structure, free to allow expression of opinion from whatever source and looking at any topic and so on and so forth? That's the question. All right, but let's put that aside and look at the facts. Suppose it's discovered that 80% of journalists vote Democratic. What does that tell you? The difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is virtually nil. These are just two factions of the business party, two very virtually indistinguishable factions of the business party. So in the last election, for example, if you had interchanged Dole and Clinton, nobody would have noticed the difference. There are marginal differences between them. True, they have somewhat different constituencies, and that sometimes shows up in small policy decisions, but they basically reflect the same system of power. So if it turned out that 80% of journalists were part of one faction of the business party rather than another faction of the business party, would that tell you anything?
Even if you take these studies at their face value, there are a number of flaws with them. Perhaps the most important one is that they assume that it's the journalists, rather than the owners, the advertisers, the news shapers, or the news makers, who control the manufacture of news. That's a bit like saying that the workers on the factory floor decide what the car industry produces.
What the propaganda model tries to do is stipulate a set of institutional, ideological variables that reflect this elite power and that powerfully influence the media.
Herman and Chomsky use the metaphor of filters. There's all this information out there, but only some of it gets through. Now, of course, the use of filters is inevitable. The news has to select and edit information. But that filtering isn't just a question of free journalistic judgment. It's heavily influenced by a series of institutional pressures, such as who owns the media, the role of advertisers, the kinds of sources that are used, and a more direct form of pressure that Herman and Chomsky call flack. Key question in any democracy is, what makes it through the filters and what gets filtered out?
goes through the filters one at a time. So we look at each of the filters one at a time. And we have, there's a few little adaptations here or there as we're going through it, which is all within the spirit of the model. And then we test it in the film on a series of domestic and international issues. The domestic issues are health, welfare, and military budget, labor, and business. In the international level, we look at the issue of dictators and massacres and who gets covered and who does not. We looked at the Gulf War. We looked at Cuba. We especially found the frame of worthy and unworthy victims very useful in this context. Actually, when I taught this, I also used the film Manufacturing Consent, and there is a superb section, which I think most of you will show later on, which is a test of the propaganda model that looks at the reporting of East Timor compared with Cambodia, and looks at the deaths and the way the media relate to those deaths. Very, very useful. Very, very useful film. However, that's what we did. It was 1998, as I said. However, there is something missing from the film. I'm talking about our film, not Manufacturing Consent. There is something very important missing from the film, The Myth of the Liberal Media. In fact, what's missing is the most important international issue when it comes to the United States, and the one that is the most spectacular demonstration of how the propaganda system works in the U.S. media. And that issue that is missing is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is simply not in the film. The question is, why not? Not important to look at? I'm asking, these are questions I ask myself. These are questions I'm posing to myself as I was the director of that film. Well, as we start to think about this, I want to see if we can demonstrate how one of the filters identified by Noam Chomsky works. When one of the filters, and one of the important filters, is that of flack. That is negative feedback to reporters and editors when they produce something that doesn't meet the requirements of the propaganda system. And I'm going to give you an example of how this filter works, not merely in the media, but in the academy as well. Because I was, when we didn't deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in this film, we weren't alone at that time. It was very difficult to find any discussion of this issue in anything to do with the media, actually, or on the left in general. And it was really brought home to me very clearly once. It was brought home to me clearly in 1997, and it was a talk that the late Edward Said, gave a tribute to the great third world intellectual Iqbal Ahmed. Iqbal Ahmed taught at Hampshire. Iqbal Ahmed is one of the most important intellectuals of the post-war era, and ended up teaching at Hampshire College, which is a college very close to where I live. And in 1997, there was a tribute that was paid to Iqbal Ahmed. And anyone who was anyone on the left was there. In fact, Noam Chomsky came, gave a very a big address. Dan Ellsberg was there, Howard Zinn was there, I mean, you name it, and they were there to pay tribute to Iqbal Ahmed. And there was at the end of, it's actually one of the great regrets of my, one of the great technological failures of my life. I was just talking to Sanjay, who was a graduate student at that time at the university, and we were taping this event, and we thought we'd got everything. It was this really incredible event. Person after person speaking in the most heartfelt way and talking about the politics and why it mattered so much. And we had a camera, it was a really good camera that we thought was capturing everything. And it never got on tape. And that's a lesson to those people who do production. Never presume that it's going to get on the tape even though it's on the camera. And it actually was one of those moments that we just lost. And I wish there was a way of getting it back. But the last person to speak on that day was Edward Said. And when Said got up to speak, he had tears running down his face. And there were tears of happiness. And he said, and I remember very clearly, he said, the reason I'm here to pay tribute to Iqbal is when the rest of the left forgot about the Palestinians, Iqbal did not. When the left would talk about anything else, and not talk about the Palestinians and the injustice done to the Palestinians, Ekbal did not forget, and for which he paid a price. He paid an academic price and a political price. And when Saeed was talking, there's one of those moments when I started questioning myself. I said, why am I not dealing with this issue? Here I am, I'm a teacher at the University of Massachusetts, a liberal university. Here I am, tenured full professor. And I am not dealing with, when I teach courses on propaganda and ideology and media and control and international affairs, etc., and I'm not dealing with the central issue and the most spectacular demonstration of the propaganda of war. Why not? Well, it's not difficult. The reason is flak. The reason is, in the United States, if you deal with this issue, if you deal with the Israeli-Palestinian issue, you will get flak. You will be called names. You'll be called nasty names. You'll be called a racist. You'll be called an anti-Semite. You'll be called a supporter of terrorism. You can talk about anything else. Talk about any. You can even talk about Cuba these days. You can talk about almost anything else. But on this issue, you are guaranteed to get negative reaction. I realized it was my own failure. It was my own cowardice that was actually stopping me from doing what I knew to be right. Now, you don't have to be brave to do it. This is not an issue of being cowardly. It's doing what is the right thing. In fact, when I heard Saeed on that day, I said, okay, it's now been pointed out, I can no longer remain innocent within this. It's now at the forefront of my own consciousness. And for my own sake, I've got to be able to deal with it. So I actually started to introduce it into my classes. And in fact, I also decided to do a film about it. And the film about the media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It was drawing from the inspiration of Edward Said and Ekbal, and using the model of Herman Chomsky. Now, just in case you want to doubt the effectiveness of the propaganda, I mean, there's lots of ways of trying to demonstrate the effectiveness of propaganda. I did it very directly in my classes, actually, again, pedagogically. What I would do is, at the start of the class, I would deal with the Israeli-Palestinian issue at the very end. But at the start of the class, before they even knew what the class was about, I did a survey with them. That is, and the survey actually wasn't an opinion survey. The survey was a knowledge survey. That is, what did they know? And then I would use that. I would use, here is the class. Here is what you know about these issues. Why do you know these issues? Why is your framework structured in this way? It's a very useful pedagogical device. It's not them out there who think this. It's you in here who think this. Why do you do it? Why do you think in that way? And it's not meant as a negative way. It's not meant as a in a pejorative way to challenge, but to say, look, this is what you think. Why do you think what you think? And so I used to do these surveys, and I used to ask one question. There was a number of questions to ask, but this was the question on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And the question was the following. So it's a fact question. It's a fact question. The question was, quote, which of the following countries has been continually condemned in the United Nations for illegally occupying someone else's land in the Middle East? It's a very straightforward question for which there is one answer, and that answer is Israel. That since 1967 has been in violation of UN resolutions in occupying the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights. And then I gave, because you're teaching 300 people, so it's a multiple choice, you have to give kind of open-ended questions on this. I did it as a multiple choice. So, number one, Israel. Number two, couldn't say Palestine, so I said the Palestinians. And then three and four were two, it was like Lebanon and Kuwait, two countries it couldn't possibly be. And what I found, again, sometimes students would say to me, like, they'd be very honest, they'd be like, we don't know. And I would say, okay, well, you have to guess. Because the guessing will tell you something. If you're simply guessing, then the answers will be all over the place. But if you're guessing with what is in your mind, then that will tell you something about how ideology functions. And in the years that I did this, between 58% and 65% of my students thought the Palestinians were illegally occupying someone else's land in the Middle East. That is the opposite way to the reality of the situation. Well, that's how propaganda works. Okay, that is how propaganda works. And so, well, you know, one of the reasons I did it was you can then start to unpack it. Why do people believe that? And when it's 58 to 65, you know, that's not individual, that's not to do with individual intellectual feebleness. That is to do with the structured stories that people are that the people are getting around these issues. And so we did a film around this. It's most probably the most controversial film that MEF has done, called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land. Now, even after I decided to do it, I was the filter was still there. So I decided to do it, and my initial rationale was I said I know. Because you know, when you do something like this, the knee-jerk reaction that the organized reaction will give you is that this is anti-Semitic. I mean, it is the insult that is always brought up. I mean, look at Jimmy Carter recently. I mean, the ex-president of the United States writing a book on Palestine, saying what the rest of the world knows to be true, and in the United States, the only discussion is whether Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite. That shows again the power of that accusation. I was so worried about this that initially I actually was going to do the film. My strategy was to use no one but progressive Jewish voices and experts to deliver the analysis, thinking that would then protect you from the charge of anti-Semitism. You know, they could be self-hating Jews, but that's not as bad as being an anti-Semite. Again, I was being driven by the fear. Actually, when I mentioned this to Noam Chomsky when I was talking about it, you know, he said, I understood the reasoning behind the strategy, but the problem is it makes it appear that only Jews have a right to speak about these issues. He was, of course, right. And I realized how I was letting my own fear. That is, I was actually trying to build in the reaction. I was trying to read the reaction before I even made it. How I was using my own fear in terms of how I would think about the film. But that's how, to guide my actions, that's how flak works. That's how flak works. And in the United States, that flak is real. It's not just a fantasy on someone's part. There are many conservative Zionist groups out there ready to pounce on anyone who deviates from the official and sanctioned story. As I said, it's the one issue in the United States. I haven't lived in Canada for quite a while now, so I'm not quite sure how that issue is treated in the Canadian media. In the United States media, it is the one issue, the one topic that you can't talk about in any kind of open and honest way. Why not? Because you're going to get the accusations of anti-Semitism. Actually, Alexander Coburn, you know, who is mixed in terms of how much, in terms of the you know, his analysis. One of the things he says when people start when you start hearing a lot more about anti-Semitism, and you hear about the outbreaks of anti-Semitism, you know that Israel is doing terrible things. Because that is when the accusation comes up. The accusation, there is a politics of anti-Semitism. Yes, there is anti-Semitism in the world, and there's ways of measuring that objectively. And then there is the way in which anti-Semitism is used as an accusation. There is a politics to it, to the discourse of anti-Semitism. So that was the next film we did. I'm going to show the next clip, which is from Peace, Propaganda, the Promised Land. Again, in this case, I'm going to show you a section where we talk about the structuring of the U.S. media and use explicitly the notion of filters, but in an adapted way. Put the lights.
CBS Evening News.
Americans rely on the news media for information about events occurring around the world. News, especially television news, exerts a powerful influence on our perceptions, telling us which events are important and shaping our understanding of the issues. Given the central role played by the United States in the Middle East conflict, and thus the vital role played by American voters, influencing U.S. media coverage of the conflict is crucial. Controlling the images and words used to explain the conflict has become an important extension of the struggle.
Israel is really fighting a war on two fronts. The first is a military campaign being waged in the occupied territories against the Palestinian people. And the second is a PR campaign being waged here in the U.S. through the American media to ensure continued support for Israel's occupation. Alon Pincus, Consul General for Israel in New York and the coordinator of Israel's PR efforts, was recently quoted as saying, "We are currently in a conflict with the Palestinians, and engaging in a successful PR campaign is part of winning the conflict." So you could say that in addition to the military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, Israel is also involved in an attempt to ideologically occupy the American media.
The roots of Israel's public relations campaign go back to the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon that earned it worldwide criticism, in particular the massacre of Palestinian civilians at the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. To the Israeli government, the problem was not the deaths of thousands of civilians. Rather, it was the damage to Israel's public image, a public relations disaster in need of damage control.
They surrounded Beirut. In 3 months, 17,500 people, almost all of them civilians, were killed. I saw many thousands of their bodies. Then came the massacre of Sabra and Shatila by Israel's own allies as the camp was surrounded by Israeli troops. And they desperately said, what went wrong? It was concluded that the problem was there wasn't good enough public relations.
After the public relations disaster in Lebanon, Israel decided to set up permanent institutional structures to control how Americans would think about the Middle East. In 1983, Israel launched the Hasbara project, the aim of which was to ensure good press in the U.S. media. The goal was to train Israeli diplomats in communications and public relations. For example, they trained press officers in Israeli consulates in the U.S. to ensure that American journalists would write stories favorable to Israel. As one of these press officers said in the 1980s, he had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with journalists, and that a typical day would involve conversations with producers at leading news and TV talk shows about the content of the program. He described it as, in fact, quote, a joint formulation of ideas. This targeting of the American media goes on in the present day.
The Israeli press office is spitting out press releases, statements, information all the time. So you could sit in a bureau in Jerusalem and file stories from there all the time without really having to have much imagination or have much energy, or have much drive. Palestine Authority press office is almost useless, and they certainly aren't providing you with ready-made stories the way the Israeli press office is.
Because of lack of access to Palestinian officials in the West Bank and the sophistication of Israel's PR techniques inside Israel, a lot of times the stories are already tilted in Israel's favor before they ever leave American journalists sitting in the area.
When you're talking about how the story is covered from the U.S., the propaganda machine is even more effective than it is in Israel.
American news coverage is influenced by a complex set of institutional relationships. These influences can be thought of as a series of filters through which the news must travel before it emerges in the voices of news anchors. To understand how American news media report on the Middle East conflict, we need to understand how these institutional filters operate. Among the most important of these filters are the business interests of the corporations that own the mass media, interests that extend beyond the United States and across the globe to the Middle East. The economic interests of media owners are shared by political elites, politicians and policymakers who form a second filter. These political elites have the power to access and influence mainstream media and are themselves part of a system dominated by corporate money and interests. The strategic importance of the Middle East to these two groups is reflected in media coverage of the region and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A third filter, Israel's own public relations efforts, further affects the coverage. The government of Israel employs some of the largest American public relations firms as image consultants to coordinate its political and media campaigns. 9 Israeli consulates help implement these PR campaigns by developing relationships with journalists and monitoring media outlets. Scores of private American organizations, both Christian and Jewish, reiterate the official line and organize grassroots opposition to any coverage deemed unfavorable to Israel. The most important of these is AIPAC, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, widely regarded as the most powerful foreign lobby in Washington. This institutional framework of American business and political interests in combination with Israeli public relations shapes media coverage of the Middle East. At the same time, those progressive organizations opposing Israeli government policy, such as Jews Against the Occupation and Americans for Peace Now, rarely make it through these filters. Finally, if any news stories critical of Israeli policy do surface, there are a host of media watchdog groups that monitor and pressure journalists and media outlets, the most important of which is CAMRA.
You have activist organizations from the right, the pro-Israeli right, that very effectively, they say monitor, I would say harass journalists and their editors and try to make sure that the coverage is objective, by which they mean pro-Israel.
You can see all of the, you know, kind of pressure groups to, you know, write campaigns of letters to the editor against, you know, news outlets and ask for, you know, demand that stories be changed or that, you know, that reporters be fired.
The abuse against a journalist is something you just have to take into account. If you, you know, both literally and metaphorically, if you work in the Middle East, you've got to take the sticks and stones. What I object to is that my American colleagues don't seem to be prepared to do that.
And even in Israel itself, you know, you can find the main daily newspapers, like Haaretz, for example, provides coverage on the ground and analysis, some of which has views on the conflict that you would never, that would be almost beyond pale for an American journalist, say, the New York Times, to write.
The main major television news networks and newspapers in the United States have long ago got their fear to be supreme over their duties as journalists. They are not monitoring the centers of power when it comes to the relationship between America and the Middle East, Israel and America, and America and the Arabs and the Palestinians. They will not ask the right questions, they will not report it using the correct words, they will not confront the reality, and they've given up. And I think once you acquire fear, it's very difficult to get rid of.
Which is, Robert Fisk says, once you acquire fear, it's very, very tough to give it up. Especially when it's part of the structure of dealing with certain kinds of issues. One of the most important aspects of the model, of the Hunter Chomsky model, is the analysis of how governments and corporations subsidize the work of media. Right? That is, they make it easy for the media to tell the official story. Now, for this to work, of course, the subsidization of the media has to remain invisible. And this is where, and I think there's great work that's been done on this in the last 20 years or so, this is where the public relations industry steps in. And the role of the public relations industry is to steer the story in certain directions so that, there really are hapless reporters, don't even know when they're being manipulated and controlled. I actually think if you ask most of the journalists, they would say, no, we do everything by free will. That's how the structure works. Okay, that's how the structure works. What people think is free will and normal, what they regard as normal journalism, is controlled in a very, very narrow direction. And if you want to, you can unpack how that happens. One way to do it is to actually have people, again, from a pedagogical perspective, have people who are in the industry talk about this. And I actually found this following clip from it. It was a film on the public relations industry. And this is from the founder of one of the public relations companies, talking about, and I think he must have found religion or something after he retired, because he's kind of laying out exactly how this works. So this is a guy called George Warden. Let me just get that.
The whole purpose of this business is to influence public opinion. Person by by person, even congressman by congressman, millions by millions, if that's the way the audience falls. You're trying to change opinion, or if there is no opinion, develop one. I can thank any newspaper, and let me have 10 minutes with a red crayon, and I'll mark it up all stories where a PR person had a hand in its creation or its dissemination. And I'll be going like this, all the way through the bloody paper.
When you can actually, even from a political point of view, you can actually have people, I mean, this is where insiders matter. When you can have insiders actually tell their stories. And they can illustrate aspects, not just them personally, but they can illustrate aspects of the structural problem. You can actually, that's a way of making the structure very, very concrete. Around the same time, I also started to work on another film actually to do with the subsidization of the media. Based on Sheldon Rankin, who I know spoke here, is here, and John Stauber's book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You. And one of the sections we looked at looks at the very, very important issue of local news. And there's a lot of attention paid to network news, etc. But in fact, in the United States, the local news is where people get their news. Local news is what they say they trust, the people they say they trust. And there's a tremendous amount of information that is passed on through the local news. So this is a section from Toxic Sludge is Good for You about local news. Can you get the lights again, please?
If you ask the public, who do you trust most for your news? Typically, the information that comes back is, well, you know, we trust our local TV anchor crew. We trust our local news people. These folks go out, they go to the softball games and the community events, they participate with the charities. They're branding their news team as being the folks you can trust here in Mayberry, USA.
In today's business climate, local news divisions are under immense budgetary pressure to be profitable. The resulting corporate restructuring and downsizing has meant that there are fewer journalists and less resources to produce the same amount of news. In this context, where news directors are under pressure to produce more for less, they are vulnerable to offers of free, pre-packaged news that allow them to produce programming cheaply and efficiently. The public relations industry has used this vulnerability to transform local news into a promotional opportunity for their clients.
That's why the world's leading companies and hundreds of other industry leaders have turned to TVI News. No matter what the topic, our Emmy Award-winning team of television journalists will craft your story into a format news stations will use. One that gets results.
Consequently, news we may think is local often isn't, and in fact may not even be news.
So this is like a dream come true for the PR people, because they can provide camera-ready content to the TV stations whose staff are too, you know, broke and too inexperienced and too lazy very often to do real news. So they take material from PR firms and they stick it in front of the audience as if it were stuff that they'd done themselves, as if it were real news. The best example that I can think of is the video news release.
A video news release is a pre-packaged news story that's been developed, written, produced by a public relations agency. Ideally, it should look exactly like the 6 o'clock news.
Researchers have discovered a compound extracted from the seeds of red grapes called Activent that inhibits and even kills human cancer cells while increasing the growth and health of normal cells. And the extract is already available in dietary supplements sold in drug and health food stores.
The video news release about grapeseed extract was picked up by a number of stations across the country, including KNBC News in Los Angeles.
and a major breakthrough in the fight against cancer, and it involves something that you might have in your kitchen right now. It is for your health this afternoon. A new study indicates that grapes may help save your life. But as our Dr. Bruce Hensel tells us, it's not the part of the grape that you might suspect. Tell us, Dr. Bruce.
Grapes may look out of place in the lab, but a new study shows that grape seed extract may prevent the growth of cancer cells. The substance is already available in supplements. The research finds
it's a story wholly created and produced by the public relations industry, by former journalists, now in PR, putting together news stories on behalf of the drug industry, the petrochemical industry, the chemical industry, whoever, at a cost of $25,000 to $250,000, providing them free to TV news directors who air them, and they do air them, with absolutely no labeling or indication that this is not news. This is a phony news story. This is fake news that's been done by former journalists in the PR industry, paid for by their clients, and we're passing it on to you as news.
Back to your body now. Orange juice does a body good, so you need to get lots of it. In today's Health Watch, besides being an excellent source of vitamin C, orange juice does much more. Sure, it's packed with vitamin C, but orange juice has plenty more to offer. It can help protect your heart by raising your good cholesterol. And when it's fortified, it's a great source of calcium for non-milk drinkers. And that's not all.
It's also rich in potassium, which reduces our risk for high blood pressure and for stroke. There are some really obvious things to look for, and it becomes pretty clear that VNR footage is being used or that you're seeing a VNR if you know what to look for. Start noticing, particularly on local news, because we all know the local news has a limited budget. They have limited resources. So when we see a story on our local news that has all kinds of extra footage from a factory, for example, or from an exotic location, or any location that looks out of the ordinary, that is most likely VNR footage.
And the news directors could easily label video news releases as footage provided by the Hill & Knowlton public relations firm on behalf of their client, the XYZ drug company. But to do that would destroy the myth of news reporting, destroy the myth of journalism.
Relief for asthma now comes in the form of a pill. The Food and Drug Administration has cleared the way for a new class of asthma medications that works through prevention rather than after an attack. La Administración de Drogas y Alimentos ha aprobado un nuevo medicamento para combatir el asma. Great news for the 12 million Americans who suffer from asthma.
The government has approved a new class of asthma drug.
It's given approval to Accolate, the tablet which people take twice a day as part of your daily asthma management.
A media system that says the base is the one we have is all too likely to use that without comment, without telling people, and certainly without having any of the people who work in the news division looking into it to blow the whistle on this practice.
I'm really going to try and get to the fun stuff. Hold on, it's coming at the end. Now, within all this work, I'm basically working within the definition, actually, of someone I imagine is not being named in this, his name's not come up in this conference. Working within a definition of intellectual work given by the cultural theorist Stuart Hall. And I say his work, his name's not must be come up because there is this artificial divide in the field between political economy and the propaganda model and cultural studies on the other. And it is a very, very unproductive divide. It's a very, very unproductive way of thinking about these issues. And I can tell you that for me, Stuart Hall is one of the most important theorists that talk about issues around media and culture and power. And if you're interested in, if you're dealing with a propaganda model and you don't deal with, and you don't know about the work, the incredible work that's been done in cultural studies around this, it's, you're really impoverishing your own model. You're really impoverishing the work that you're doing. But what Hall talks about, he's been very influential in my work, he has a dual definition of what constitutes progressive intellectual work. On the one hand, he says, firstly, we have to have the commitment to the most rigorous and objective analysis and understanding of the existing order of things.
We have to understand the world the best that it can be understood without regard to dogma and to narrow-mindedness. That is, we have to have a commitment to a kind of scientific approach. We have to go where our analysis takes us. If we're interested in changing the world, you've got to know how the world works. You can't let ideology get in the way of that. Actually, just as an aside, we can argue about this. As an aside, actually, I think we are, the left and progressives, I think we are smarter than the right. I think we have deeper understandings of the world in all its complexity and sometimes its contradictions. And that's why the right has now turned its sights on the academy. The academy, in fact, is the last place. I'll talk about the United States, but I don't imagine it's that different in Canada. The academy is the last place where there is any kind of diversity and where there is any kind of critical analysis still existing. And that's why the right now, having taken over politics, having taken over popular culture, having taken over the media, that is why the right now has turned its attention to the academy. It knows that when students are presented, are exposed to our ideas, that is, when there is a real choice presented to them, they will invariably go with the smartest analysis. And that is why the university and colleges and independent intellectual spaces are very, very dangerous for existing power. And they have to make sure that those spaces are closed up. In the United States, the attack by David Horowitz and his supporters is based on ensuring that this last vestige of diversity is eliminated by means of intimidation and threat. And there actually, I'm not really kidding, there actually are bills before state legislatures about what can get taught in a classroom. That is, I mean, you don't introduce bills out of thin air. That is an end result of a very, very specific and coordinated campaign directed at the university, directed at, as I said, I think at the last place in society where there is any kind of independent thought. So that's the first part of Paul's analysis. Well, first part of Paul's definition. The best work, intellectual work that can be done. To understand the world the best it can be understood. But the second part of Paul's injunction is equally crucial. And that is, he says, the knowledge and research that has been generated, understanding that has been generated, has to be translated into forms and languages that non-experts can understand and engage with. Translated. The analysis by itself, the academic analysis, the stuff that we write that about six other people read in academic journals, and the language that the field has said is the way in which you get tenure. Right? That is not the language that the vast majority of people understand. And what we have to figure out is how to try. There is reasons for specialized language. There is reasons for specialized theory. That is how we move knowledge forward. But once you've done that, you've then got to think seriously about translation. How do we translate it into a language that other people can understand? In fact, for me, when I think about this, I'm always thinking, I mean, from a teaching perspective. For me, my target audience, actually, for not only my classes, but also in my films, is teaching a large lecture, that kid in the back row, I suppose baseball hat on, who comes and reads his newspaper, doesn't really want to be there, but he thinks he's going to get something by osmosis just by being there. That's where, there's a reason why people are in the front row. There's a reason why people are in the middle. You have to be able to reach everyone. But you also got to be able to reach into that back row. That is where, I think, the politics of intellectual work are really located. And so you've got to think seriously about translation. You've got to think seriously about how to do it. By the way, if you want to model, Karl Marx is the best model that I know of.